Welcome to today's Brown Bag Lunch. I'm Colonel James Minnick. I'm Associate Dean here at APCSS. We're super glad to have you out here. I'll tell you that by virtue of the number of people that we have here assembled, there's absolutely no doubt that North Korea, in the issues that are going on the peninsula, is prevalent within the news, within our governments as we look at it. Now, it has been the same for a long period of time. And those who have been associated with issues on the peninsula knows that this has been continuous. We are just perhaps in a more difficult period than we have been at times recent. So I do want to talk about the denuclearization of North Korea. I've talked, I've written, I've published, I've lectured on this for a number of years. And if I were to, some of you may have seen, I went and I actually hid the sub-bullet of this because I wanted to tease this out. But if you're asked, how long have we been looking at policy options in North Korea? You know, some think, well, I've been thinking about it for 5 years, 10 years, is it 15, 25 years. In 1991 is when the first policy was signed that leading towards this effort of denuclearization. That's a long time. We'll talk about that a little bit here. But I think some of you would be surprised at the duration, at how long we've been looking at this. This is difficult. And if it did not matter, we probably wouldn't need to put focus here or anywhere else. But increasingly, this is becoming more dangerous. I won't ask you how to think or what to think in this. And you may not agree with some assessments and some viewpoints that I will share with you. But I would like you to be informed as you think about and talk about these things and understand the complexities. They don't just central on one or two dates that you may put your finger on. These things have been going on for a long time, and they are clearly connected. They're not disparate activities that have occurred. I'll try to draw that connection with you and help you understand why this complexity is as it is. And so, 25 years is how long we've been trying to resolve this problem. As we go through this, let me probably lump these in four main topics that I want to talk about. I want to talk first, it will be, about North Korea's pursuit of nuclear weapons. Then I want to talk about national interests vis-a-vis North Korea's nuclear interest. What are the policy options that we have undertaken over these years? We'll understand those. And then what can we do? What are those policy options available to us today? Those are the things we'll talk about. We will then have plenty of time for a Q&A as well. So maybe I'll start with this, along their pursuit, North Korea's pursuit. This actually begins even earlier than what I show on this slide. Probably 52 is about the time that North Korea begins efforts in atomic energy. But they will send scientists, through agreements, send scientists back to the Soviet Union, and they will train hundreds. And then they will have an agreement with the Soviet Union, who will come in and they will build North Korea's first reactor, its nuclear reactor. It's a research reactor, it's small, 2 gigawatts, and it actually never becomes part of an agreement that we will be familiar with. The one that we will talk about through the years on the policy effort is the next one that you see listed there. And in 1986, North Korea will have completed construction of its own 5-megawatt reactor. They had asked the Russians to build that reactor. They had built the 2-megawatt reactor earlier that I mentioned. The Russians said they wouldn't. They asked them, after they did, they asked them to provide the fuel source for them to be able to fuel this. They said they wouldn't. And so the North Koreans then built their own fuel fabrication facility so that they could then fuel this. They then will, as years go on, they will go from a plutonium-based effort to a highly enriched uranium. And those dates are on here, and we'll talk about it. That has yielded them some capability today. So if having fissile material is the first element of being able to have a capability, I think everybody has probably come to the realization without any doubt they have that. You must be able to fission that material. When I was first was writing about this, talking about what they may have had was a conjecture. No, they hadn't shown it yet. But since 2006, they've now conducted five underground nuclear tests. You must then, if you have fissionable, fissile material, you must then have a delivery, a payload delivery means. The harder part of that is the miniaturization of it so that you can put it on rockets or missiles to be able to launch it. There becomes a weight restriction. And so there may be arguments to where North Korea is in its delivery ability. But you can explode a nuclear device without having to have a payload delivery. You pull it up in a ship. I mean, there's multiple ways of being able to explode one. So the argument of where they are in their delivery system with miniaturization, I would say, is a bit moot. The Non-Proliferation Treaty, which we'll talk a little bit more about, kind of categorizes those who have nuclear weapons into some bins here. And so there are five nuclear weapons states per the Nuclear Non-Proliferation Treaty, agreement signed in 1970 after the establishment of the International Atomic Energy Agency back in the 50s. They established this agreement, this treaty, NPT, treaty, so that they can kind of hold in place the status of what it is. At that point, there are five states who possess nuclear weapons, atomic weapons or nuclear weapons. And you're familiar with those. They're the same as the permanent five members of the UN Security Council. But there are other nuclear weapons possessors, those who are not members of the NPT. And you're probably familiar with those as well, Israel, India, and Pakistan. There has been an agreement that the United States had with India that has made a pathway outside of the NPT for India to be able to not be sanctioned for its, as it had been, for its possession of weapons and facilities that are, as long as India, which they did, agreed to put those facilities under the observation, under the safeguards of International Atomic Energy Agency's safeguards. So then that leaves the states of immediate concern. No doubt, North Korea possesses fissionable fissile material. They do. And they have tested that. Now, whether it is in a device or not, there have been discussions about that as well. It has not been shown to the public that this is their nuclear weapon. But there is assumptions that they possess probably as many as 20, and they possess some, and even more. And they possess both plutonium-based weapons as well as highly enriched uranium. Many of you are familiar with the issues with Iran as that agreement was done. Some of you may be less familiar with Syria. There have been a number of efforts by Israel to stop different states. Syria was the last one in 2007 when they conducted an airstrike. These other states listed here are of interest as well. And these are states which formally had a program and for different reasons had ended it. I will tell you that the first one, Belarus, Kazakhstan, and Ukraine, is unique because when the Soviet Union collapsed in 1991, here these new states possessed nuclear weapons in their country. And there was an agreement that was struck to be able to have them surrender those weapons back to Russia. And the agreement, referred to as the 1994 Budapest Memorandum, was it. The reason I bring this up is because the issue in Ukraine and the Russians' aggression there, having seized and occupied areas of it, is telling because, well, in 1994, three countries signed an agreement with Ukraine saying, we will provide security assurance for you. Who were those three countries? It was the United States, UK, and Russia. And how well did that work when the Ukraine had real security concerns here recently? It was just a piece of paper, right? The other one let me mention real quickly is listed down there is South Korea. So South Korea had a secretive nuclear weapons program as well. They had it all the way up until the very early 80s. So President Park Chung-hee had developed this program. Why? Because in the early 70s, the United States was talking about seriously withdrawing from its forces from Korea. So in 71, President Nixon reduced the forces by 20,000, down from 61,000 to 41,000. And then you'll remember, some of you, where President Carter, from the day he began campaigning, spoke about how he was going to withdraw all forces, U.S. forces, out of Korea. And that was in 75. President Park Chung-hee was then assassinated in October of 79. In December of that year, then Major General Chun Doo-hwan usurped authority in a coup, and he took over. And he was a possessor of this program they had. Illegitimate that he was. And I will tell you that many of you will know of the Gwangju massacre then that occurred in May, just a few months later. In May of 1980. It was a putting down of a democratic uprising against him. 13 days after President Reagan took office, he conducts his first state visit in the White House with whom? President Chun Doo-hwan, who took over in a coup. Offering through that meeting as an extension of legitimacy with the United States. Why would the U.S. president do that? I would offer it's because he did two things. Number one is he, for South Korea, well, two things for South Korea. One is he extended legitimacy, and he gave an assurance that the U.S. was not leaving, and it would stay there. And from South Korea, there was an agreement to eliminate its nuclear weapons program. And so South Korea, when they thought that they had no other, when they were running out of security options, went that direction. This is important. And the reason it's important is when you think about national interests. I've listed here intensity of national interest. There's vital interests. This is like the survival of your state. Important-ish interests. These are for your national well-being, but at a degree below survival. Peripheral interests. These are resemble more along national values. So why do we care in Korea, in North Korea, with its nuclear weapons? Well, for the North Koreans, they see this as a cornerstone essential to their survival today. If we are going to make a change in North Korea on its nuclear weapons program, it will be because we will satisfy this insecurity, which is, frankly, reinforced through many things. Reinforced just lately with the missile launches, the TLAM missiles in Syria. That feeds to them that without nuclear weapons, they would be attacking us as well. Or efforts on the last slide, where Libya had a program, and when Libya got rid of their program, we know what with the fall of Gaddafi, etc. There are plenty of examples, Iraq, etc. So what is it then that the United States wants? I've been going to Korea with the U.S. Army since 1982, and that sounds like a long time, I guess, and maybe it is. It was a long time ago. So, and my entire time there, North Korea has always been an aggressor. But until they had a capability to affect the United States homeland, our degree of interest was about keeping it just over there. That paradigm has changed. And since they can affect the United States has taken a, since the early 90s, an increasingly more deliberate and forceful policy to try to change this. So those are the vital interests for the United States. I will tell you that, you remember this, security is interest number one. And whatever, for states, and whatever their other interests are, they are distant second. States will do anything to maintain their survival. So what is at stake? So if this is important, there must be things that could go dreadfully wrong if we get it wrong. Any thoughts? What are some of the things that are at stake here? I'll give you one to start off. The threat of a nuclear strike against the U.S. mainland. That's a risk. And I alluded to that to the last one, spoke about it even. Threat to the U.S. forces. It's the alliance and the allies that are there in the region. What else is that threat? Risk of a preemptive war or anticipatory self-defense. Probably a differentiation there. Preemptive, if you know that somebody's getting ready to launch a missile to you and you preempt it before they can launch it off the pad or something like that, that may be preemption. Anticipatory, or even maybe more loosely, preventive, maybe because you're taking actions because one day you think you may be a threat and you want to get in front of it. And we've seen some of that. But that's at risk. There's a risk of conflict escalation. You think you control it here, but before you know it, it could escalate into uses of nuclear weapons. The proliferation risk of those weapons, technology and knowledge, to others. A weakened NPT, Nuclear Non-Proliferation Treaty. It is quite possible that this doesn't contain itself just on North Korea. I could, without too much stretch of imagination, I could see how countries in the region, Japan, South Korea, others, could go nuclear. The leading conservative presidential candidate in South Korea right now, you know, they'll hold an election on the 9th of May. And while he's not the leading candidate, the leading conservative candidate advocates South Korea possessing nuclear weapons. And his name is Hong. So that's certainly at risk. Unabated human rights in this humanitarian crisis that continues. We talk about how abhorrent it is. And it is. It is abhorrent. It gets no better just to talk about it and not be able to take actions to affect its change. And that's all we've done for years, to say it's a terrible human rights conditions, we ought to do something about it. It only gets worse. A Japanese resurgence, or its preemptive policy. A worsened U.S. relations with China, Republic of Korea, Japan. There is much to lose. There's much at stake by not getting this right. Policy efforts. 1970, I told you, is when the Nuclear Non-Proliferation Treaty was put into force. 4 years later, North Korea joined. That's pretty good. And then just a few years after that, 3 years after that, they then signed the Safeguards Agreement to be able to put the research reactor under the protocols of the IAEA. They then say that they will, they sign the NPT, but then having signed it, you've got to put it into force by putting your facilities underneath the safeguards. But they hold out putting their facilities under safeguards under a condition. And that condition is that first the United States removes from South Korea its tactical nuclear weapons. April in 92, they then sign and put their, after U.S. nuclear weapons are removed from the peninsula, they then sign the NPT. I'll tell you that in the next slide, I'll walk down a little bit of chronology on that. But I'll tell you that all that is pretty positive. They then submit their initial reports up to the to that safeguard, and only after that do things start going squirrely. But before this, there's a lot of positive happening. I'm going to take you here. Some of you, most of you probably do not ever recall hearing about this agreement. It was the Joint Denuclearization Declaration, signed between North and South Korea. This is a landmark agreement. It actually came coupled with another agreement before it. And so the closing days of 1991, the two Koreas will first sign a reconciliation, non-aggression, cooperation treaty. And then a few weeks later, they will sign this joint declaration on denuclearization. How did we get to this? This is real goodness. 1991, the world is significantly changing. A lot of things happened that year. Let's see, you've got North and South Korea will be admitted as member states of the United Nations. That happens in 1991. You have the United States in September of that year will agree. President Bush will sign the Proliferation Nuclear Initiative, Presidential Nuclear Initiative, and he will remove all nuclear weapons from South Korea. Soviet Union will collapse. The Soviet Union will have started normalization relation talks with South Korea. The world that we were all accustomed to, including North Korea, is significantly changing. And they reach out and they sign this landmark agreement right here, which has been upheld and continues to be as the best effort in the denuclearization. It was an equal agreement. They agreed not to to possess or store or to have in any form nuclear weapons. They also allow them to use, as is authorized by international community, peaceful use means. This falls apart. There's so much goodness going, and it immediately falls. Why does it fall apart? The United States, some of you are familiar that the United States conducts today large exercises in Korea. Used to be an actual tactical exercise, very large, with forces that maneuvered around, and it was called Team Spirit. Began in 76, 78, began back in the 70s. And it continued all the way up until it held its last one in 1991. But after signing this agreement, they then canceled the agreement. That's one. They will then, the United States will then, and South Korea will then hold that exercise. After having canceled the exercise, they will then hold the exercise. And it is a source of great friction. And then this North-South committee to go and look at sites to verify that nuclear weapons are not there and that efforts aren't going on has a lot of distrust. I will tell you that this is one of the good takeaways from this is that absent trust, it becomes very difficult to be able to conduct an agreement that is based on trust. So if you don't have trust, you say you must be able to, we will do these following things, and trust us, we will do them. And even if you have inspection teams go in, you always suspect that they're hiding around this other corner doing wrong. And we have seen that time and again. And this is the first one where it fails apart. The United States will then try an effort. And what brings us to 94 is that we come actually to a precipice of war. Many of you may remember, but the United States was considering conducting surgical strikes in North Korea in the 93 time frame. And the reason they did it is because North Korea had decided that they were going to withdraw from the NPT following the breakdown of that last agreement. Former President Jimmy Carter, went into North Korea and had a meeting with Kim Il-sung to try to bring this to its a peaceful outcome, and he was quite successful. And as a result, coming out, we ended up going into an agreement that last negotiation for 4 months that produced this agreement called the Agreed Framework. The Agreed Framework was signed in October of 94. In July of 94, Kim Il-sung had died. Many people didn't believe that Kim Jong-il would be able to consolidate power and that he would then be able to actually retain authority, and if we just waited, this would all resolve itself. That didn't happen. This agreement was intended to normalize relations with the United States, and it was going to exchange or transfer some non-proliferation light water reactors for exchange for the North Koreans to shut down its more proliferable graphite-moderated reactors. The North froze their program for 8 years. They froze it. In fact, the IAEA in the first month had verified it was frozen, and they monitored it for 8 years as it stayed frozen. But there was some disingenuousness with regard to both sides, perhaps, with seeing this thing through. This thing will then collapse. And it will collapse at the end of 2002 under the Bush administration. And the Bush administration, after Secretary Kelly coming out of North Korea, will state that they have a concealed program, and that they will on enriching highly enriched uranium, and therefore they're at fault, and they will end this agreement. You know, they'll then go into six-party talks, and those will go from 2003 to 2009, and in the end, all they will do is get back to the same place they were before, to agree to those same types of agreements, and it will fail. And if more time, I would take you down here and help you understand the reasons for failure. But they're much of the same, just a different part of the problem in a different period. But they still fail. The Obama administration will then try in this Leap Day deal, and for the same reasons, types of reasons, it will fail. So we've been at it, and we continue to work back to the same type of efforts, and they continue to fail. So what then, how do you get somebody to do something? You want them to do something. How do you do it? You can use coercive power. You can reward them, and that's a form of power. But those require, either one of them, require to stand over and make sure it happens. And absent, you know, the person trying to change, it's difficult to enforce these. A legitimate power. People do things because that agency or person which is asking them to do it, they see legitimacy in, and therefore they do it. They do it because they hold referent power, and often associated with, perhaps affiliated with Kim Jong-un even right now. They do it because they have great respect, or maybe a religious leader, things like that. They do it because you're an expert, and finally they do it because they've received information to understand it. But to understand how to get them to actually be willing to listen, and you've got to understand what powers you're going to bring to be able to influence the outcome. So this is about how you could bin what we could do. There's subsets, but you can either coerce them to do it, or you can work cooperatively to have them get there. So we just went through 8 years of strategic patience, which is kind of pressure without negotiations. You just work through tougher sanctions. And no doubt, if we people say, we just need to put the screws on harder, I will tell you that sanctions or economic warfare, the ones who suffer the most are the people. Those are the ones you're strangling, not the administration. We need a policy of regime change, is what people say. We just need to go in there and get rid of them. So Kim Jong-un is the third dictator. What makes you think that the fourth one is going to be better than the third, or the second, or the first? Regime change is unlikely to change the situation set. We can just contain them. They've got what they've got and will contain. Okay. I've heard that as an argument. Preemption, we've talked about that. We will just fire upon them and force them that if they keep this up, we'll keep shooting them. The danger here is North Korea has great capability to retaliate or to respond even in self-defense back. This gets ugly really quick, and if we had time, we'd go into it some more. You've heard we just need to get China to do this. We need to outsource our diplomacy. That just means we don't have our own policy if we need to figure out for somebody else to figure out how to do it. And so we can negotiate diplomacy, and this is difficult. But denuclearization alone is not normalization. From North Korea's perspective, it's capitulation. And so if that is the answer, we probably ought not even try. There has to be something more than that. Now, I advocate what we need is a policy of changed regime. Not regime change, but changed regime. And I have, many people said, you can't work with North Korea. I disagree. They have asked to be to move into the U.S. orbit. They have asked that. Said that they're too corrupt, or their human rights violations are too egregious. It's never stopped us before. This can be done. But number one, they must have a security assurance. And I would tell you that a security assurance would take what we currently extended deterrence over the South Korea, and we'd extend it over the entire Korean Peninsula. And it must be believable. It's going to have to be more than just words. We must normalize relations with North Korea. These aren't sequential. Most of these things have to happen right away. And I'll tell you, in a normalization, I'm talking about political and economic for sure. The day after an agreement, you could exchange teams to open up liaison offices. You'd open up embassies within 6 to 12 months. This could change significantly. No doubt, the nuclear weapons and the nuclear weapons program must first be abated. It must be stopped. But it's been frozen before. It's been frozen many times. But we need to work through it, and then eventually we would abolish it. There must be cooperative prosperity. And there is a great opportunities there. I'll tell you that China reaps alone, mostly, the benefits of North Korea's mining industry. There is great wealth to be pulled out of there. I would reopen again the Kaesong Industrial Complex and the Mount Kumgon Resorts, and there are plenty other joint ventures that could be opened in economic zones. There's going to be a transfer of some type of energy, and we have done this in other ones. But in all of the other ones, we spoke about transferring light water reactors. And while those themselves may be proliferation resistant, you have to have highly enriched uranium at a low percentage, but you still must be able to do that to create the fuel for these things. And once you have the capacity to create highly enriched uranium, you just keep doing it until you get to weapons grade. And so if you don't have the trust to have that, which there is no trust, why would we want to transfer this capability? So it would be, I would advocate that it's hydro and it's coal, and these are prevalent within North Korea and could be transferred as an exchange. And then we must meter all our other interests. When you look back, and I went back past some of those, but I will tell you that some of the reasons they failed is because after signing an agreement, in fact, all of them, after signing an agreement said, and now you have to do this, 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 this. You got to get rid of your chemicals, your biologicals, your missiles. You got to end terrorism. You got to improve your human rights. You got to reduce the size of your conventional force. You got to account for abductees in Japan. I mean, I can go on. The list goes on. But if you want it all, it'll probably be like we've got. You'll get none of it. And so we got to focus on that, which is important, and we must remain persistent in our efforts if we are going to change the situation in North Korea. But if governments are happy with where it is and where it's going, we can continue doing what we've done, because we'll probably continue to obtain those types of results. But if we want change, we've got to figure out how to get there. So I advocate that we must then induce a changed regime policy in order to bring about this change. I'm going to stop right there. And I am going to thank you for your participation, and then let us go ahead and open it up for questions and answers.